Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So, Guy, Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Control Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets.
You did, and in fact, that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So, join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon, and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever heard, frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour.
Hi, Gary.
Hello, Guy. We were just talking, weren't we, about this new phenomenon that happens in a bar in Islington to do with a song of yours.
Yeah, Tony Swain, who produced True album and obviously Gold, sent me a clip that his daughter had taken. She goes to some bar in I don't know where it is, in my old hometown, Islington, obviously. And at the end of it, and you can hear it's the end of it because people sound pretty drunk. they sing Gold. They play Gold over the stereo, whatever it is. And at the moment of Tony singing Gold, they throw ice onto the ceiling. It's a thing.
It's so sticky and horrible to sweep up afterwards.
Yeah, but 41 years later, who would have thought it would still be a thing? You know, I'm sorry.
I brought it up. Yeah, but, yeah. talking of recording, of course, we've been in the studio this week. I've been working with you at Rack, the legendary old London studio.
Yeah, you know, I love Rack. It's Mickey Most's old studio, isn't it? You know, Mickey, the great old 70s pop producer.
There's something like ridiculous, like something like 700 million records with his name on it in some capacity, either as producer or writer or artist. And because I remember I used to do tons of sessions in there back in the day. And what was legendary was you'd walk in and there's that little office at the back, which you see behind reception, and he would just be lying on the sofa. He was lying there all day, every day. In fact,
not without a telephone to stare at. What was he looking
at? That's right. Well, daytime telly, I guess. But I don't know. That was before daytime telly.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It was just the
Evening Standard.
Yeah. Crosswords. Recovering
from an all-night session. But you know, I used to...
No, but we'd all go in and sort of asking about Johnny. There's Johnny Marr, who always comes up on this. Had a really funny story about like going in there. I thought, and he'd been reading about Terry Reid. I went, Terry, oh my God, Mickey Most did him. So he went in and said, Mickey, can you tell me about Terry Reid? And he asked him and he goes, yeah, well, I saw him in a club and he sounded amazing. So I got him in here and it just wasn't working, wasn't happening. So then do you know what I did? I set him up in the studio like he was playing a club with a PA. And that was it, it worked. And then cut to a few weeks later, Johnny says, I'm really on this Donovan tip. I walk and there's Mickey. I go, hey, Mickey, so tell us about Donovan. He goes, you know what happened? I saw him playing in a club. Exactly the same story.
I can't remember the bands he produced. I mean, who were the?
It was pop, wasn't it?
Smokey.
Yeah, I used to have a guitar of his. In fact, I had his Fender 6 bass, which I had to sell it during COVID. It was I've got a picture of John Paul Jones playing it. He used to use it on sessions, and I know it was used on the intro to Sunshine Superman.
Oh, amazing. Of course, he did Donovan, of course. But and I used to love the Rack label.
That ship was it? Was it Contiki or something? Or
ship.
But it was like the... No, it was, but wasn't it the famous old thing that went across the Atlantic or whatever?
Why?
Tiki, what?
Why did Mickey choose that?
I don't know, maybe he owned it.
But what we liked being in the studio, the old posters, because there's the Mickey Most, I think he was a Jewish boy from South Africa, wasn't he? And
that's right.
And of course, he was a musician right at the beginning of rock and roll, you know, and he played Mickey Most and the...
At least.
The somethings.
Mickey Most of the least. Probably.
But there were some funny posters.
There was some, that's right, all the kind of Larry Parnes type names. And I can't remember the artist's name.
Colin someone.
It was Colin someone. And the Cabin Boys.
Yeah. Imagine
couldn't
if you
do that now, could you?
You couldn't. But imagine if you were a Cabin Boy. But that's your memory of rock and roll. Yes, I was.
I was one of the Cabin Boys.
But it was great to have you down there playing bass on, obviously, my own.
It was
stuff.
Really good fun.
And I was thinking that maybe we should just talk about great studios that are left, and there aren't many now, are there?
No, there's Rack, there's
Air for doing big
Air for orchestral. Oh, that's a shame, because we were talking about this when we were there, because the old Air, the original
in Oxford
Air,
Street,
the only place where there was daylight. You know, the whole it was just amazing, because you were looking down on Oxford Circus.
You were. That was amazing.
So, where did we park? I mean, talk about simpler times. Well, getting stuff up and down.
We got the limo, didn't we?
You might have.
Do you know what?
This is why I played Steinberger back then.
I'll tell you a funny story about Air. I was there was a party being thrown there by Prince Charles and Princess Diana. And it was to thank everyone who'd done the Prince's Trust. So this is in sort of like, I don't know, 87 or something. I don't know. It was a bit earlier than that. And Spandau had been invited because we'd done a Prince's Trust concert up in Ingolstadt, up in Scotland. That Charles had come to. So he's having this party, and I think there's like, you know, Mark Knopfler's there and Robert Plant's there, and it was a big do. And as the artists were, and George Michael maybe, and as
the great and the near great.
Yes, exactly. So this is a story about the near great, obviously. and so the street was lined with people, and you know, the little barricades were up, and the
did you have to go through them?
Yeah, right. No, and snipers on the roof, you know, so I'm told. This is snipers on the roof. And as the stars arrived, you know, all the fans in Oxford Street was screaming and screaming, you know, and it was waving at them as they went into Air Studios entrance. Spandau, we wait. Well, because we're all lined up in the limos, and Spandau's turn to get out and wave at the crowd and go in happened. And so this is an evening party, and we pull up, we get out the limo, we wave at everyone, and the people are screaming, "Tony, Gary, sign this," and I can't right now, I've got to go and see Charles and Di. And we walked in, but we didn't walk in. We walked into Dulce's shoe shop next door that had that kind of locked door just a little way in from the street.
Brilliant.
Bang, you know, and then we had to come back out again and do all the waving and the more sort of shamed waving as you went in. But I suppose in the old days as well, it was Townhouse, wasn't there? I mean, look, Townhouse.
What was amazing about Townhouse was in the 90s, I had a studio there. Because Townhouse, you had this amazing, it was all the Steve Lillywhite records. It was the drum sound of the 80s, wasn't it? We used to have a joke about what we call the Townhouse career path, which is that you go in one week and there'd be some guy, some sort of 16-year-old, like tape-op, and you'd sort of he'd be getting smacked around the head and sent down the cash machine and sort of to make the coffee. But then you go back 10 days later and he's producing Scritti Politti.
But I think that's interesting, isn't it? Because also having studios had their sound, didn't they? You know, and obviously Townhouse created a sound. Well, you went to Abbey Road, which is still there, obviously.
Oh, that's sorry, we missed that.
We missed that. But I think that idea that you could discover a particular sonic possibility within a space, I hate to say it, we say it a lot on this programme, it's gone, right?
Yeah, it has, yeah. But then also...
Instead, you're at the whim of what logic give you or what some... You know, of some new software thing that's come out.
But there's a funny thing about that, isn't there? Because there's a reverse thing to that. For instance, like, people will obsess over trying to make their records sound like Exile on Main Street, right? For instance, that's the thing. How do we get that exact sound, right? The Stones didn't want that record to sound like that. They were stuck in a basement in Nelcott, in Keith's house, and they're just doing the best they can. And it's like, this will have to do. But then whatever that sound, if you make something great, then people are going to want to do that. Do you know what I mean?
But it's the hang, isn't it? Because that was what they were after. They were trying, you know, obviously part of that and not paying tax, obviously. But but it was...
and drugs.
It was the hang. And so... You know, I remember, you know, we enjoyed that being in Spandau. You'd go to the Manor in Oxford where Tubular Bells was made, and it was basically, you know, Richard Branson had put in a studio into a manor house. But you got to hang out and not be disturbed by the outside, not go to a clubs.
Yeah, but may I say, this is why, certainly in my sort of salad days of the 80s, that's why kind of my least favourite studio back then was Abbey Road. Because Abbey Road wasn't a hang, it had that... BBC feel. It had the 9-to-5-y thing of like there was the canteen and and it just felt a bit 9-to-5 compared to everywhere else.
Yeah, I mean the best hangs were always abroad, weren't they? You know, like there was, you know, Air Montserrat, which I never went to, but
well, Compass Point, which of course we both know.
Compass Point,
that very, very well. I went to Eddie Grant's studio in Barbados.
Yeah,
went to work there with Gary Moore, and that was a big deal for. And what was very funny was that we got there, and it was just after the Happy Mondays had had their absolutely disastrous stint there, where they just ruined everything and
decided it was an instrumental album because none of them could sing properly.
And basically, somehow, sort of, you know, I think Barbados ran out of drugs. so we had this terrible thing. Like, for instance, I kept trying to rent a car. And they go, yeah, fine. And it just never showed up. It never, ever showed up. And it was like, I just don't understand it. We're an English group staying at Eddie Grant's studio trying to rent a car. And for some reason, they won't provide us with one. Apparently, the Happy Mondays had written off like 17 or something. In fact, there was a great story of apparently once Sean went out and he wrote some car off. And there was a thing with some weird primal memory thing of his where he salvage what he could, and he was seen. He was seen walking up the drive to the studio, carrying a bumper.
The thing is about going to Nassau for us as a band to do the True album, is it wasn't just hanging out. It wasn't just the sound of the studio. It was the sound outside. It was the music that was being made outside, and the different weather. And I mean, I guess it's like, you know, going to Muscle Shoals or. You know, you're inspired by who's come before, aren't you?
That's right. Well, with Muscle Shoals, it was very much about the musicians, wasn't it? Though, although they seem to be able to.
Was that where the Funk Brothers were? Have I got that all wrong? No.
The Funk Brothers was Motown. The Muscle Shoals. That's a whole other story.
Of course, we went to Motown as well.
Went to Motown. Yes, I lay down on the very spot where James Jameson had to lie down. To play the bass on What's Going On because he was too drunk to sit on a chair.
Because Marvin Gaye had written the song late in the evening, early morning.
That's right, and it was still, when things were still 9-to-5 at Motown, and the Funk Brothers had the regular gigs in jazz clubs around town. Yeah. That's right. And so I think it was Berry or someone recorded, just called every club in town until they found them. They got, what's his name, the drummer. They said, "Listen, you guys have got to come back because Marvin's got this thing and he's on it, you know." They said, "Listen, James is pretty drunk. That's fine. I don't care going back." No. He's really drunk. But what's extraordinary is that he came in and he couldn't sit in a chair, so he just lay on the ground and played, without a doubt, just one of the most magical bits of bass ever committed to tape in history. Amazing. And I can't tell you the amount of times I used to try and explain that to producers.
I'm worse for wear because...
I think, may I remind you about James Jameson's stellar performance?
James Jameson.
James Jameson.
So they named a whiskey after him. Anyway, sorry, we digress. Our next guest, our guest today, has got a great studio in his house. I mean, I can't believe... both of us had dinner with him separately, I'd say, within the last few months. And
We never dined together.
You're ushered through to his studio, and it's phenomenal what he's got
beautiful.
In his house.
But what's really lovely is all right, quick footnote. And I've never said that, but he used to... You know,
is this to be edited out, or are you just whispering?
No, I don't know, let's see. He used to have this studio in his old house out in... Is it Church? It says in the book. But it was this legendary studio people used to run out. And I don't know if he still had the house at the time, but when the studio was running. And I did a session there back in the late 80s. And it was the first time I ever met Magnus Fiennes. He was producing it. And it was some
Rafe's
African...
Rafe and Joe's brother.
The middle brother.
The musical one.
And it was for some African princess. It was a funny old session. And for some reason, I couldn't be bothered to take my bass back to London. They said, "Don't worry, all the stuff's getting shipped back."
She wanted to go straight to the Groucho.
Yeah, but it was my Steinberger. Yeah, right. It was my little stick bass. You carry it in a little gun bag anyway. So, and I left it there, and all the gear went back to this record company in London. And then someone came in and stole all of it and took it to Paris and sold it. So unfortunately, my only memory of Phil Manzanera's old studio. It's the only place I've ever had a bass stolen from, which was my Steinberger.
Wasn't Nick Beggs, was it? He plays a Steinberger, doesn't he?
No, he plays a stick.
Oh, does he play a stick? I guess.
Serial number 712, if anyone is out there. Steinberger.
Keep them peeled.
Perhaps you saw.
Thanks, Sean.
But anyway, but what's the lovely thing about Phil's now studio, the gallery it's called, which is, you know, been quizzed by, and it's like on the second floor, third floor of this place. And what's so sweet is that Robert Wyatt records there, didn't, or certainly did, and he has it all set up so that Robert can get moved up. He gets basically carried up into the top floor and he doesn't have to come down until he's finished the record.
We've got Phil in because he's got a book
to
out.
Phil in.
I can't even say the title of the book. Revolution?
Revolution to Rockthi.
To Rockthi.
That's easy for you to say.
Revolution, yeah. That's Revolution to Roxy, Revolution to Roxy. And it's a beautifully put together book.
It's fantastic.
So many great photographs in there. Obviously, he has an amazing collection of his old, you know, I have virtually nothing. I think I have two school pictures of when I was a kid. And he's, that's really because we've had him on before. He came on.
He's an early friend of Rock on Tours. He came before we actually had a podcast when we were actually trying to put this thing together.
He did.
So obviously, I've worked tons with Phil. We've done all sorts of mad things. And
I can see him. I can see him waiting in the wings. Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah. Two
get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Phil, hello.
Hello, lads.
Hello,
Phil. Nice to see you.
Early supporter of the podcast, you were.
Absolutely. I was one of the guinea pigs, shall I say.
But he works.
That's not quite the word, did we? We didn't actually have a podcast. No, the idea was, no, you were number three, literally our third. And the idea is, well, we had to get to 10.
Yeah,
That would be a sort of critical mass where we could then sort of put out a podcast. I mean,
something like that. Because I think yours went out September 2020, but when I think we recorded it months before.
Months.
And no one knew about COVID.
No.
So I think we need to be careful, you know, if we don't, you know, no great virus happens again after this.
Please, no.
But yeah,
I can see a conspiracy theory forming already.
And then, of course, we ended up on Zoom, and I think that Zoom's become the normal thing. So it's really nice to actually be face to face here with you. And
you're certainly the earliest guest we ever had who's still in the intro. So I think
correct. Yes. Yes, I'm trying to remember.
Nick. Oh, no, Nick. There's Nick.
It's Nick. It's Nick.
Sorry.
Congratulations. You just had a number one album, haven't you? With Rod Stewart.
Well, Jules Holland.
And Jules Holland. Right. So you co-produced quite a bit of it?
Well, apparently 7 of the 13 tracks. But, I mean, it was a couple of years ago that I was called in to perform a few sort of production duties. And, it was obviously out of my comfort zone, you know, with a big band, swing music.
Okay, so why were you called in?
I was called in, I think, because the other guy couldn't make it. I think it was Nitin Sawhney was doing it. And they needed a pair of safe hands. And so I got the call and I thought, well, what can possibly go wrong? It's 16, you know, fantastic musicians, Jules Holland, Rod Stewart. And, you know, I think, as I say in the book, I'm not afraid to fail. And bizarrely, it was number one. It was like, how did I get here? It's like a lot of the things in the book. How did that happen? You know, I'm trying to make sense.
Yeah, because your remit is incredible. Like, as a producer as well, fantastically broad. You basically sort of own that whole rock en español thing.
Rock en español, sí, señor. Claro. Yeah, and they're still winning Grammys, those artists, and still, in fact, one of the guys is playing Madison Square Gardens in 2 weeks' time.
That you produce?
Yeah.
What's his name?
Enrique Bunbury.
Yeah, Bunbury doesn't sound very Spanish, though, does it?
It doesn't.
Everybody
does it?
Needs a Bunbury.
But obviously, it's not his real name.
But
why did he choose Bunbury? I've got no idea. He
was clearly a huge Oscar Wilde fan.
Oh, it must have been, yeah.
What was your connection with Rod, though? Did you work with him before?
No, never met him before. I always wanted to meet him.
So Jules?
Jules, yeah. Obviously, when I helped produce the Gilmore album.
Of course, it's Paul Loseby.
Yeah. And... yeah, he's managed by Paul Loseby. Paul Loseby manages David Gilmour. So yeah, I was probably number one on his who the hell can I ring list.
But do you think your skill is sort of being comforting to the artist?
People have often said it's like I'm like a facilitator, you know, so and I'm very collegiate is another word that's been used, which I don't use, but I've heard, seen that about me. So I can get on with people and I'm very positive, of course, as you know.
So you're a vibe.
Unbelievably positive. But one thing, there is a side to you that, Phil, I would say that people don't necessarily know, which, especially if some people know you through your playing, your group, right, which is, you know, which has been everything for sort of experimental and mad, is that, and this is what I certainly saw of you with David, is that how meticulously and thoroughly you can go through stuff and work through things and pick stuff out and put things together with it. You know, you're actually a real kind of fly dentist.
Forensic. Forensic is the word you're searching for.
It is, although forensic does actually mean for the courts.
Well, yeah, that there's lots of court cases in music. Yeah,
sorry,
in music,
that is exactly what you meant.
Yes, exactly. No, that's right. Attention to detail. But, you know, I had that my basic philosophy, I suppose, for producing people and stuff has been based on a mixture of George Martin's approach and Brian Eno's approach, and also Ian McDonald, who I was at school with, Ian, the brother of Bill McCormick.
He wrote the Beatles,
Revolution in the Head. And he said to me, Phil, way back, he was a bit of a mentor in some ways. He said, always think conceptually and think of the context. So as a producer, I will say, what are we trying to do here? To somebody, yeah. You know, and the musical context really has evolved from working with Roxy, because what we did in effect was provide a musical world for Brian Ferry's voice to inhabit, you know, and so very much concentrated on that inner world that you can see through the speakers, almost visual
cinema for the ears.
Yes, correct,
as it were. Yeah, you started with Split Enz doing production, didn't you?
I started with Eno, actually doing his taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy albums, co-produced, and then and working with him on his first Here Come the Warm Jets, and then one thing led to another, and I think before Split Enz it was John Cale.
Oh wow, yeah.
Yeah, so by the time I got to Split Enz, it was like 1976 or something.
Let's talk about this book.
Because what's extraordinary about this book, right, and I said this to you personally anyway, as a friend, is that there's a whole aside to it other than that there's, you know, rock biographies are one thing and they can be fabulous, they can be dull, but this is, if you take all that out,
just
the family stuff, it is such a thrilling, right, it's so. Asking you about your childhood in the book feels less like interviewing someone about a book and more like calling someone in for a sort of MI6 debrief.
Because it does read at the beginning. I mean, the first three or four chapters, it's like a Graham Greene novel.
Well, very appropriately, of course. And, you know, in writing this memoir, I was asking myself, what's it all mean? You know, I was trying to make sense of what happened, not only to my family's history, but also my musical history that starts with in Cuba and then ends at the O2. Well, not ends at the O2, but the book ends at the O2 with Roxy, our farewell last gig. So I'm trying to make sense of it. And so, you know, if I scroll back and I started digging and delving, yeah, obviously I get taken to Cuba when I'm six, put in a Cuban school. Within 3 months I can speak Spanish, and I'm bilingual. A very brief account of what happens, the revolution happens, and then we'll
get to more detail.
We have to leave, but really, you know, as a family, you know, especially on my mother's side, we are 50 cousins in Colombia presently, and
Christmas must be
hell. Well, one of the accounts in there is when I go back in 1991, and
I have
to leave quickly because I can't take it. You know, the meeting at my uncle's house with all of them, just too much. And they've been very happy to find out where the hell we came from.
Because what obviously this book reveals is you have so much great photography stuff. Photographic.
I was going to say, yeah, who the hell has so many pictures of their childhood?
Well,
sorry, I didn't mean that. That sounded terribly accusatory. That wasn't meant to be.
No.
How dare you?
Well, you know,
he's bad cop today.
All this thing about whether my dad worked for MI6 and stuff like that, and
yeah, that's
go into more detail. But you know, we did have Leica cameras. We did have shortwave radios. We did have,
yeah, that's very MI6
Super 8 movie cameras. So there is lots of Super 8 of me, and there's me in Havana with
microfilm
and a pen that they took oxygen out of.
Well, microfilm. There was little cameras that I still have. I must go back and have a look in cupboards. Thanks for reminding me.
And I bet you probably haven't. Yeah. Although you were actually born, for all this glamour and excitement, you were actually born, and this warms the cockles of my heart. You were born half a mile away from me in St. Thomas's Hospital.
In St. Thomas's Hospital,
where I have my appendix out.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, opposite the Houses of Parliament. How more British could you possibly be? My dad used to say, you know, when we were living in South America, you're a Cockney because you were born within the sound of Bow Bells.
Let's just get the background then. Yeah. So your dad's English and who he works for, and then your mum
is Colombian from Barranquilla, Colombia, on the Caribbean coast, the home of Cumbia, the place where everybody who came in to take over South America from the 16th century onwards came past Barranquilla, because on the mouth of the Magdalena River, and Magdalena is like the Mississippi River, you know, it goes through the whole of the country, and she was called Magdalena. My
Aunt Thames, have you ever met her?
Yeah.
Sorry. But yeah, it's amazing.
Was she an Avon lady? Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, everything, the whole history of Colombia is based on the Rio Magdalena. Right. Everybody who came up that river to get to the Andes.
How many songs are there called Magdalena from Colombia?
Well,
18,000.
Well, there's one. I've definitely got one on the album that goes with this. And it's, a tribute to Magdalena.
And was she playing music at home when you were in England? Was there an association with Latin American music? Or
not at all. No, because we're talking about, you know, someone who came to England in 1948 from Argentina with my father, and they'd got married in 1941 and came back, a Spanish-speaking lady to Gravesend, and must have been very difficult for her, you know, because she was a foreigner. And I sort of realized that I'm sort of mixed race. I didn't really ever think of myself as that, but I have a Colombian mother and a British father. So she found it difficult, and it was very cold and grey and black and white in England in the 50s. Going back to Cuba and Havana, everything turns into colour again, and she starts learning to play the guitar with her Italian.
Oh, that's right. There's the picture of her in the.
Yeah, and
that's just a whim. She just thought, I'll play guitar.
Well, Franca, her friend, was a good singer, and they used to like to sing songs together. And so they started having guitar lessons. And I still have that Cuban guitar made in Havana. And it's in my writing room, and I see it every day. And I just have to play one chord, an A minor chord, and I'm back in South America. It's so nostalgic and beautiful, you know, and it's a beautiful shape.
It must save you a fortune. An A minor.
Did that inspire you? Is that what made you think I'd also like to play this thing my mum's playing?
If you're 6 or 7 and someone's playing a guitar, I know, because grandchildren come and do it. They come and pull the strings on it and like they start hitting it and banging it, and that's exactly what I was doing. And she was saying, "Oh, mira, deja de hacer esto. You know, stop doing that. I'll have to show you what you're meant to do with this." And she started teaching me acompañamiento, which is bang, 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 that kind of thing. And then you sing on top of it. And then you sing all these songs, which are ingrained in my brain, all these Latin American and Cuban songs that you can hear in any restaurant down here in a Spanish restaurant in Kensington High Street.
But this is
people have enough drinks.
So this is coming from a completely different place than it wasn't, "Oh my God, I heard Hank Marvin."
No, nothing, you know, so nothing like that. This is totally Latino. And of course, I was being taken to the Tropicana Club and the Sanssouci Club as a 6-year-old, you know, with like these incredible dancers with plumes on their heads. you know, very reminiscent of what we had in Roxy in 2001 tour. And there's a little boy asleep, you know, on a chair while they were all watching all this, you know, Celia Cruz and all these people at the height and the prime, the people from the Buena Vista Social Club, performing in those two clubs. And I recently saw Godfather Part Two, and there is scenes from 1958 going to 59 in Havana at the Tropicana Club, and they got it right. I mean, I think you've probably been there.
I have, and it's quite, it's a bit sad now.
Yeah, it's a bit sad now. But that's
the costume. Getting to the Moulin Rouge now, isn't it?
Well, it's like the costumes all look a bit amdram, and everything's obviously just been sewn up.
Well, you should want something different.
Yeah.
I was trying to blend in.
But what I realise now is that music, right from those early days, helped me, right from then.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right through to now. Continue to start.
Was setting up BOAC, was it?
My dad was setting up, he was
apparently.
Well, the airline company he worked for, didn't he?
Yeah, BOAC was now British Airways.
Apparently.
Okay. It was a government organisation. But, national. You know, the centre of Havana is very small. You know that. I don't know if you've been, Gary.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it's very, very small. My dad's office, 100 yards away from my dad's office, Graham Greene, exactly the same time, writing Our Man in Havana. Now, two Brits, two tall Brits, in such a close quarter. Graham Greene, MI6. It's unlikely they wouldn't have gone round to Hemingway's to have
a
mojito or something. But, you know, we were very friendly with the British consul, the British ambassador, you know, all everywhere we lived. I spoke to the British consul, who was British consul there at the time, about 10 years ago, and he'd retired, and he's living near Brighton, actually. And we went round to see him. I showed him a picture of, in our garden, of guys in sort of white shirts, you know, very 50s sort of civil service. I said, "Who are those?" And he immediately said, "Spooks." You know, wow. And I just, my brain went, you know, we've got to keep investigating. So that's what we did. We went to Churchill College, Cambridge, where papers were and read letters.
See, this is what I mean. You're so good at that. You're, yeah. You're such a good cop.
What did you discover?
Well, discovered, for instance, and if I also watched at Christmas, Our Man in Havana, the Graham Greene, Carol Reed film with Noel Coward and Alec Guinness, right? So there's a hilarious scene. It's a very funny film.
It's a brilliant film. It's one of my favourite visual gags ever.
And Noel Coward comes from it with two books, and he said, "We're going to communicate, you know, the encoded by these two books. So you keep your copy, I'll keep my copy." Well, when we went to Churchill College, Cambridge, we found a letter from my dad to his boss in Argentina saying, look, well, actually, it was from the boss to my dad saying, go to this bookshop in Charing Cross Road, buy two copies of this book and send me one.
It's Lamb Shakespeare in the original book, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. So, you know, all these little clues. Now, I've got no idea for certain because you can't access the files, you know, it's you're not allowed to.
Bloody official secret access.
Are you suspicious that he
was? Well, you know, there's so many.
Well, you did tend to turn up places when it was literally about, you turn up somewhere next door to the consulate, next thing you know, there's been a revolution and the regime has been overthrown.
Let's talk about
this. This happens about five times. Well,
but the thing is,
it's quite funny, we've got you in the right.
All these, honest, I didn't do it.
Yeah.
Plus having the cameras and everything, you know, I've got the Leica still, and I'm thinking, you know,
have you ever really taken it apart?
Yeah, have I really looked at all the canisters of film that I still had from back there? The other scene in Godfather Part Two is, which is absolutely brilliant for me personally, is the night of New Year's Eve when the dictator Batista. He's in the ballroom and they're all having New Year's Eve and all that. And someone comes in and says, oh, Che Guevara and Camilo Sanfuego have taken Santa Clara and they're on their way to Havana. And so they all say, oh, Christ, you know, let's Scarpa. So they all rush down. It's hilarious, out of the building and onto the Malecon and get in their cars and drive off to the military airfield. So if you scanned 1 mile away, you see our house in our garden with a gun battle from our garden to the chief of staff of the dictator, and us on the bathroom floor with my mother screaming and pushing our faces down and bullets flying everywhere. And then they all scarper to this airfield, which is about 5 minutes away from our house, and take off with loads of money from the National Bank and stuff. But for me, watching that in
the
film...
You were left behind, obviously. You weren't escaping.
No, we weren't. Of course not. No, because we're just...
You couldn't carry enough money.
Foreigners. So then, you know, it's all hell breaks loose. We watch on telly the next morning, and there's a picture of it, the tank coming into Havana with all the barbudos, as they call the guerrillas. And then there's people looting the house in front, cars turning up and people going and just nicking everything.
Did you have security on your house?
We didn't have security in our house, but eventually, a few days later, they put security guys in green fatigues and to guard the house to stop the looting, right? So there's this guy sitting over there, and my mum looks out the window and says, poor guy, he's sitting there so bored all day. Why don't you take him a coffee? So I take him a coffee, and he's happy about it. And he says, fancy going in? So I go in. And then what does...
You go into...
Into the looted house.
Of the chief of staff.
And it's like about 2 foot deep in sort of debris and smashed stuff and all that. And what does a sort of 7-8-year-old look for? I take his gold epaulette off his dinner jacket, which I have with me still every day next to my mum's guitar. I take three...
Which Roxy album cover are you wearing that on?
Actually, thinking about it, there is one of Brian's outfits that does have those gold epaulettes in the first incarnation. I took a photo album. I took a photo album that
How
had...
How old were you then?
7, 8, I can't remember exactly. 7 turning 8. I took a photo album which had pictures of British Air Force people with the dictators, people, because they were selling them planes. I didn't know that. I didn't know if anyone knew and stuff. Mysteriously...
So you were a spy?
Well, mysteriously, that photo album when my dad died in Venezuela in 1965 disappeared. So I've never seen it again. So anyway, it sounds like I'm making this up, doesn't it?
But you're saying that these were photos of potentially people who were working for the British government.
Well, I don't know. You know,
other ways.
I've scoured lots of books about what the position was of the British government to do. But as always, it's all about selling arms, isn't it?
Well, surely it was
different countries
to bolster the dictator, wasn't it, originally?
Exactly. But...
well, it's anything you're allied to, against anything that sort of has a whiff of communism at that point, aren't you?
At that point, everyone was paranoid about communism.
Yeah. And were they welcomed as they came into
They
Havana?
Were totally welcomed. It was very, very popular. Everybody, I mean, some of the undercover guys worked at my dad's office, apparently. But I tell you the amazing thing, they were into merch. And you know, a couple of days later, two green lorries came from either end of the street, started handing out caps and armbands to the kids. And there's a picture of me with, you know, my black and red.
You haven't still got that, though.
Yeah, no, I haven't got that. But
still got the laminate.
But there's at least I've got a picture with me. It looks as if I'm holding a machine gun, but it can't be. It must be toy one or something, and the guy's got a real machine.
I don't know. Maybe they weren't messing about.
But so there's lots of adventures.
And but I would have got the feeling your dad would have felt a bit unsafe at this point.
Well, there is an article with him in a newspaper in Hawaii because we got posted to Hawaii.
Because almost, of course you did.
Of course you did.
Almost straight away.
We went to New York. I have a picture of the plane and the propeller. Of, you know, when we left Havana, everybody clapped like mad. I don't distinctly remember. I've got pictures of me and Super 8 footage of me walking down Fifth Avenue in 1959, and then I was watching the telly in the hotel room and with my sister, and my dad came back. He'd been to the office in New York or something, and I said, "Where are we going?" And I was watching. I swear not. I was watching people surfing on Waikiki Beach. He said, "But that's where we're going." I said, "You're joking. Hawaii." But, so we went to Honolulu. Yeah, and there's an article with my dad in the paper which talks about what happened on that night of the gun battle from our house and everything. And it's in the book, you see. And that's how I, you know, it helps me remember all this kind of stuff. And I thought, am I making this up? And then I read him an article in the newspaper talking about it.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a lot of research. You did a lot of research.
There was a lot of research because it was a bit like, you know, who do you think you are? You know, we're on the discovering stuff. And that's just the half of it, obviously. You know, when I discovered that on my English side, my grandfather wasn't my grandfather, my cousins weren't my cousins. This a dying aunt tells me your grandfather on your father's side was a Neapolitan opera musician from Naples. Ah. It was like, I said, you know, she thought I was going to be really worried. I said, that's brilliant. Thank you. It's so much more exciting than what I thought it was.
What spoils things for you, I would have said, Phil, is that, like, the whole thing with rock and roll, with joining back, like, for Gary and us, when you start playing, and the first time they put you on planes, you went to Ibiza very early on, and with me it was Paris and Stockholm, and then you go to Germany, and then you go further and further out, and it's more and more exciting. For you, nothing. You know, it's like...
Well, no, and actually, when I joined Roxy, I was still getting free flights on BOAC.
Because here's another thing. As a kid, never mind Havana, never mind Waikiki Beach. You've been on a plane.
Yeah, not
you
only...
Mean, no, who of your peers has been on a plane?
I didn't go on once I was 17.
Yeah, but not only a plane guy, a Stratacruiser.
Yes, exactly, with the couchette and everything.
What's a Stratacruiser? Stratacruiser was...
It was between the Telecaster and
it should have been the name of
it. It's a great guitar name.
Man's near a Stratacruiser.
There you go, with a couchette.
Go on, describe
it. I had a cocktail bar downstairs. It's very Roxy, isn't it? But it was an amazing plane that lasted 2 or 3 years before they invented jet aviation with the 707 plane. That's why I'm a complete expert on planes, obviously, because I've been on every iteration of plane, you know, for the last 60 years. plane ball. But it was, you know, they had couchettes like on a train. You know, the top things came down bunks, and you slept. Obviously, it's first class because my dad is a company. Travel, we got to travel, you know, how would you like your boiled eggs, sir? You know, and then go downstairs to
boiling egg at that altitude though, isn't it?
did you going to Hawaii, I don't know how long you were in Hawaii for, I've forgotten now, but
when it became a state.
Hawaii, I mean, it? Gary, that's book him, Dano, right? That's what Hawaii
exactly.
was to us.
Were you aware of the change in the music for you there? Did you
absolutely Have you? But you probably never listened to the B side of Pyjamarama. It's called. It's my first track written by me on a Roxy album.
What's it called?
Single. It's called Hula Kula, and it is Hawaiian music with, you know, Brian, Andy, and Eno on gazoos behind me. But it's totally because of the fact that I was brought up in Hawaii.
So how long were you in Hawaii for?
About 9 months. I went to school there. Every day after school, I'd get on a bus, meet my mother at Waikiki Beach, and get on a surfboard.
Who are the other kids? Who are the other kids at school? Are they American
Hawaiian.
Kids? Are they essentially American?
I've got this footage of me, because my mum was a Catholic, of having a first communion in Hawaii, and they were with a lovely Hawaiian little girl.
Yeah. And did you get taken to clubs like you did in Cuba and listen to music?
No clubs.
Or was the music on the streets? Is it just there?
You'd go to things called luau's, you know, which with hula dancers and things like that. And they would cook.
For our listeners, Phil just did a seamless hula move.
Hula move, with the grass skirts.
He's born to it, I tell you.
I loved it. And of course, the minute, you know, we moved from Hawaii to Venezuela, Elvis brought out Blue Hawaii, you know, the film. So it was like double whammy. I'm seeing Elvis and he's
validating Hawaii
Yeah, exactly. And I hear rock and roll.
And then you went to Venezuela?
And then went to Venezuela.
Oh dear, so you first starting hearing Elvis through the films.
Yeah. Although you could then buy the albums.
Yeah.
And so I'd still have those albums, yeah. bought in Venezuela.
And so why were you in Venezuela?
Because the regime was about to fall, obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
Actually, funny enough,
yeah, funny absolutely.
He had just fallen with the dictator.
Yeah, Paris what they Venice. Need is a BOAC route.
Yes, and that's open up the office. And the route was yes. Bogota, Caracas, Venezuela, Trinidad, Barbados, Antigua, Bermuda, London. And
that's Moscow.
So what happened to you?
That's the flight that I did. But
what? Wow.
What happened to you in Caracas? What was?
Well, I went to the British school and made friends with a great Venezuelan guy. And, you know, it was a mixed class and we used to have dances, you know, lots of salsa dancing and stuff like that. I could dance then. Seemed to have lost the ability to do it. But we saw these American college kids come over and play at parties that we would go to. And they were playing Buddy Holly stuff, and they were playing Beach Boys stuff by then. And we could see the girls look at them. And so me and my friend Miguel Sanchez Vegas, we said, we got to get electric guitars. This is obviously, you know, what you have to do.
Can I just go back. So you've got your guitar, and you're still just playing this sort of Latin music on the guitar.
Well, I've got my mum's guitar, but yeah. Then a British boy comes out, and he's at a school in England, a boarding school called Lancing College, and he's got a Hofner cello guitar, and he wants to sell it to me, and he shows me a Chuck Berry riff, and I think, what the hell's this? And it's terribly difficult to play because you've got to move your little finger all over the place. But I'm hearing it and I'm really liking it. So I'm beginning to understand a bit more about this kind of stuff. So I write to England and ask for some instruction of how to, and this, how to play the guitar. And this thing comes back, which is all written out with no pictures of where to put your fingers. And I think this is just a complete waste of time.
No Bert Whedon.
No Bert Whedon playing a day books. And then I think, maybe I should go to England. My brother's already at boarding school. And my parents, send me to England. Oh,
right. Because of a guitar.
I was just mad about music by then.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
And you got your first guitar on hire purchase, didn't you? What happened?
I'm in England for 1 year already. It's my 10th birthday, and I get a postal order for £5. And I find this catalogue from Bell's Musical Instrument Shop in Surbiton, which I still have, and it's got a picture of a red Hofner Galaxy guitar.
Yeah.
And it says £55. It's an HP £5 deposit. So I think, right, okay. I send off my £5. I must have filled in form.
Because what year is this?
This is like 1961.
61. That's really expensive.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
But I had no idea of money at all.
Well, it's the same guitar that Mark Knopfler... he bought a £50 Hofner.
Yeah, it wasn't a Galaxy. It was
no, but
are you sure? Well, it could have been. Yeah, I listened to the thing and I thought, oh, hang on, it sounds sort of similar. I must ask him. Anyway, it arrives, at the boarding house in a sort of alligator skin sort of rock and roll case. And I think, wow.
That's 20 quid right there.
Yeah. And the housemaster says, you lout, you're not allowed that. I'm putting it in my study and you can have a look at it at XEF weekend or something, or half term or something. And I think, oh, that's a bit mean. Then I get a solicitor's letter, comes to the boarding house saying, we're going to take you to court because you haven't paid the next month. And I'm sort of, next month? I've no idea. I thought it was a fiver.
Brilliant.
I thought that covered it. So I get on the plane to Venezuela and, you know, it's London, Bermuda, Antigua, and it's getting closer and closer. And I've got a solicitor's letter and I've got the guitar. And because my dad worked for the airline, he could come on the plane. So I get to Maiquetía Airport. He comes on and I'll be panicking the whole journey. And I have the letter from the solicitors and I just show it to him. And I show him, you know, the guitar. And he said, what the dickens? What's this? You know, it's like, and, you know, I'm crying by this stage. And he said, oh, okay. Let's get through customs. we get home and he says, what? Well, it's an electric guitar. I had no idea what it is. Plug it in then. He thought you plugged it into the wall. I said, no, you don't understand. You need an amplifier. And he just, what's an amplifier? But he relented. He got me a little amplifier.
And then, funnily enough, there was a coup at Bell Musical Instruments. And the management were overthrown.
So that's how, you know, I got my, I still have it. It's beautiful, actually.
You have everything. That's the thing. Yeah, you're a great collector, aren't you?
Yeah, because they sort of travel with me, all this stuff, all my vinyl I've got from
your
Venezuela.
Your place isn't that big. Cuba, I'm amazed that you can...
From Hawaii, from Cuba, you know, Hawaiian music, luau music. I've got the vinyl, yeah.
Still. When you came back to England and you started wanting to be in a band, as it were, and you were in, you know, quite some role. Did you feel that you were a different guitar player? That you were a guitar player that was... Is peripatetic the right word? I think it is. That's travelled?
No. I just wanted to learn. But I couldn't really learn properly. Because, you know, everybody at school said, oh, right, let's play Crossroads by Cream. And I would learn it. And everyone would say, you're playing it wrong. Everything I tried to learn, you know, like a Beatles thing... You're playing it wrong. There's always some smart ass at school who play it absolutely, technically, perfectly. In the end, I just say, I'm doing my version of it. So by happenstance, I ended up creating a style which was based on a whole bunch of mistakes, really. You know, what you're not meant to do.
And but so, you've got all this Latin stuff that no one else has got.
Well, I can do all that stuff, but nobody was interested in it. And nobody was interested in any of my Latin... background, you know, the whole of my time in rock scene, all the interviews I did, no one ever asked me about my South American roots or anything to do with. No one was interested in music from any other country till about 1990, when Peter Gabriel started, you know, working with artists from other countries. And the Buena Vista people turned up. Suddenly, everyone's loving music from Cuba and say, oh, there is music from other countries.
Well, when I worked in Cuba, because I did, you know, I recorded a lot of stuff for two TV series there. But it was really interesting because in Havana, you do not mention the Buena Vista Social Club.
No, it's not, weird, isn't it?
Yeah, they don't like it.
Yeah, that's a whole other...
But I suppose in a way, you gravitated to the right people. I mean, Eno, you know, made... Yeah. I mean... say something like Bush of Ghosts that he made in the late 70s, you know, early 80s, had a lot of world music feel in it. So this is a guy that's also, he must have sensed who you were.
I remember reading an interview with him in NME at about 1979. It was a big centerfold thing. And there was one of the headlines was, I've got this big psychedelic vision at the moment concerning Africa. For some reason, that's stuck in my...
Yes, I mean, he's an explorer. Because, musical explorer as well, isn't he?
Because you're saying, Phil, that how no journalist, no one ever asked you about your... What about the band?
No. I mean, I think when they read the book, which they've now all got, I think they'll be quite surprised. So guys don't talk about... if you're on tour, you're talking about gear or the gig or what club are we going to after the thing or... And then when you finish the tour, you all go home. You don't want to see the other people socially normally. except for you two guys, see each other. But
and you.
Yeah. So there's so many things that typical bands with guys don't talk about, you know.
And it wasn't until feelings.
Yeah.
It wasn't until feelings. You get into your sort of more solo stuff that you start to explore the music from the past. Really.
I mean,
because it's always been there in your solo stuff, hasn't it? But it's almost like in code. Like now, we
coded.
Can,
yeah, now
Diamond Head and
People
the first
said,
track on Diamond Head is sung in Spanish.
Frontera, yeah. But people, you know, didn't ask me actually. Why is it called Diamond Head? They thought it was some sort of heavy
Diamond
metal
Head
thing.
Sounds like a proggy title, doesn't it?
Why is it called Diamond Head?
Well, it's called Diamond because that's the volcano at the end of Waikiki Beach in Honolulu, you know, which I used to see every day. So, and that, you know, nobody noticed that there's a track called Hula Kula on the B-side of Pyjamarama, you know. Why was that? You know, it's because
But
of
Hula
that.
Kula sounds like that's a wacky 70s type people call, you know, you pub rock bands would have titles like
well,
that.
Well, you
know.
Say that, but... Well, Kula Shaker called himself, but I mean, not Hula Kula.
Because thinking about that rock, because I know we've discussed Roxy and you, Johnny Roxy, before, you know, people can listen back to that. But thinking about Roxy and that period, it was the first postmodernist rock, really, wasn't it? There was a sense that they were almost impersonating ideas of, well, I guess it was very pop art to do that, wasn't it? The way certain pop art artists would take everyday things, Americana, and turn it into art by looking at it from a different angle. There was a sense of that in Roxy, wasn't there?
Yeah, if I try and make sense of what Roxy was, you know, now, I look back on it and I think, what kind of band was I joining? I, from the age of 9 or 10, wanted to be, like most musicians my age, wanted to be in a band like the Beatles. A bunch of wacky guys who you thought all lived together. We'd all seen the films, you know, and Help. They all appeared to be living in the same street, the same house, and just having fun the whole time. And so, and the Four Musketeers or Five Musketeers or whatever, mm-hmm. One for All and All for One, or for None. Or however, looking back on it, what I joined was like an art collective. I mean, Eno has a great... way of explaining this now. I saw it the other day in an interview he did. He calls it a senius. I hate the word senius.
Is this the most Eno thing ever?
What does that mean?
It's like a scene. So if you imagine like Paris with all the painters in the 20s and 30s, you know, they all used to know each other. Yeah. And they were. Now, can you imagine a bunch of painters forming a band, of painter band? And so they say, well, let's make a painting together. And so, you know, Picasso starts doing something and Monet, hang on. And then Jackson Pollock comes and says, what are you doing? You know, so that's the kind of thing that I joined was almost like an art collective. Eno calls it seniors. And basically everybody started doing other things almost immediately.
On the point that Jeff Dean, who's written another very good biography I'd recommend, you know, who wrote Kinky Boots, was in Modern Romance, something like that. He's a great writer. He talks about being a fan. Mm. And he said, the thing with Bowie and Roxy, because we all loved both, right? So the thing with Bowie, you got the feeling he knew exactly where he was, exactly what he created, and exactly what he was doing. Mm. Whereas with Roxy, the thing was, this is all being made up in front of you.
Totally.
As it happens.
Totally. It was very organic in some ways. It was like cooking or something, a little bit of this and a dash of that. And it all
Andy Mackay has actually used the Modernist Cookbook as an example.
No, Andy sums
it up. The Futurist Cookbook, sorry.
Andy sums it up very well, you know.
Yeah.
I'm trying to make sense of what it was. You know, I was just incredibly lucky to be in the right place at the right time to meet those kind of people.
Do you think class has anything to do with this? And I say this because, you know, the thing is about, you know, where did bands start in our heads? It's the Beatles, right? Four working class lads coming together in a gang, because working class kids hang out in gangs because that's their strength. That makes them much stronger. A bunch of kids who went to private schools, boarding schools, art schools, coming together as they did in Roxy. Well, have less inclination to be a gang.
You're wrong. Brian didn't go to public school. Eno didn't go to public school. Andy didn't go to
Yeah, you're right. Brian was working class.
The only person who went to public school was me, and I joined through an ad in Melody Make. And however that, but I must say the public school that I went to was 95% of the students there were there for free, being paid for by their local councils. And it was part of something called the Dulwich Experiment. And Peter Gabriel's guitarist was there, exactly the same, David Rhodes.
It's not like Genesis. It's not
It's not like Genesis at all. Dulwich wasn't like that kind of public school. It was very much a post-war experiment where you either let boys come to the school if they pass the 11 plus, or you got turned into a secondary modern school, you know, because that's what happened after World War II. There was no money left. Everyone was being bumped off.
And, but this idea of a band as a gang and it permeates out into the fans, doesn't it? That you know, people talk about Spandau Ballet and they say, but you know, you were all such good friends. Well, probably not. We just happened to play those instruments that were right, that we all got together in a music room. We didn't get together because we were friends.
No, exactly.
You know, and some bands, but the do. Audience likes to
yeah,
think that.
I don't think there is really an absolute. There's been two. I know what you mean. You look at, you know, because
I think the Beatles set that up, didn't they? That idea. Yeah, but that's none of them a myth. Did a solo album a until they also, finished.
Because I mean, they weren't working class.
But
anyway.
they didn't do a solo album until they finished as a band. They didn't dare. But with you guys, it was like, well, hurry up and do the solo album. And Brian was already doing it, wasn't he?
Yeah, no, totally.
Well, you all did. That was part of the deal, wasn't it?
Well, they wasn't all it? Once they'd all done them, I said, "What?" I put my hand up and said, "Hang on, what about me? Can I do?" I said, "Oh yes, you go off and do something. Yes, you know, keep yourself, provide it's in between the tours or something." But actually, talking about what you were saying, Gary, maybe it, you know, there are a bunch of guys from art schools. Or art derivative and university type people rather than public school people. So, you know, Brian Ferry, Brian Eno, Andy Mackay, and then they picked up me and of course Graham Simpson, who was the original bass player, who was at Newcastle University with Brian. But then me and Paul were picked up through ads. Yeah, so, you know,
that classic ad.
It's a classic ad.
But what your point is that their art school background made them more individualistic.
Well, no, that's where they're coming from, rather than coming from, you know, a working class, thing. It's more like art.
I mean, I stand by this idea that Roxy were probably the first postmodernist.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Well, what about Velvet Underground and stuff like that?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, the British.
Well, that except there's a lot of bands are art school generated as well, aren't they?
So you do your thing, Phil. We'll jump down to see art and Pete. say you know
the Who.
Why did you after Diamond Head or I think it was after Diamond Head or at least some stage after that decide that you would your solo album would actually be another band 801?
Well, I didn't decide that. It just happened. If you're working with Eno, things happen. And he said, "I've got this great idea. Let's form a band. It'll only last 6 weeks, and we'll get people and then."
So McLaren almost.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a conceptual situation, conceptual art project. And into this conversation came the McCormick brothers, Bill McCormick, and Ian. We went to a little cottage,
Matching Mole, right? Bill
McCormick, Matching Mole, and 801 Live. A bass player, and had been in Quiet Sun and stuff like that with me and Ian.
Was there a connection, sorry, going back with McCormack, or am I getting this wrong? It's the other one, with Robert Wyatt's mother.
Yes, that's right. The two people I met when I was 16 was David Gilmour, just joining Floyd, and Robert Wyatt. And the reason for Robert Wyatt was his house was halfway between the school and where Bill and Ian McCormack lived. And their mothers, Robert Wyatt's mother and Bill McCormack's mother, were supply teachers at the local prep school. And they'd met. And Honor Wyatt, Robert's mum, worked at the BBC before that and stuff. And Soft Machine would rehearse in the mum's front room. So every day, Bill would go home and pop in for a cup of tea and see Robert Wyatt, Kevin Ayers, Mike Ratledge and stuff playing in the front room, and became friends.
The Canterbury scene was...
The Canterbury scene was in Dulwich, in West Dulwich.
I never quite understood that.
Yeah. But they became dead trendy. They were the coolest groups in London 1968, you know, with early Pink Floyd, with Sid, and playing at the Roundhouse.
Can I just step to the side for a second? Because I didn't realise that David O'List, who obviously played on the first... Well, was the first guitarist in Roxy Music, who you sort of ousted, as it were, left and
self-combusted.
Actually, listening to some of David O'List stuff, there is elements of your style in there as well. I get that psychedelic style, which kind of came out of Sid, really. But I was going to say that David O'List was the first choice for Pink Floyd when Sid left or went a bit strange.
Was he?
And he, for a little while. He did a couple of gigs, or he did some auditions.
I didn't know. Well, shall I tell you probably why? Because the famous tour that I saw at the Albert Hall, which was Pink Floyd with Sid, The Nice with Dave O'List, Amen Corner, Jimi Hendrix, and had toured over America and came to the Albert Hall. So they were a touring like evening. They must have known each other through that, so it's quite possible.
I think David took over a couple of times on that Jimi Hendrix tour.
Maybe.
That they did.
That might make sense.
We'll come back to our listeners.
We'll come back, because I think of someone meaning
801.
Stirring something.
We were on 801.
801. 801. So we go away to the country and there's the place is leaking, and I've got footage of this, actually, funny enough. And it is decided amongst us that there will be three proper musicians and three non-musicians, and then they'd fight it out and see what happened. And we would reuse material from Quiet Sun, from Eno's solo albums, and a couple of covers. And actually, this is brilliantly put in Bill McCormick's book that's just come out, because he has a lot more attention to detail, much more forensic than me, and you can read a lot about
Christ. That
in that.
It?
No.
20,000
pages. It's about 600 pages. We went to EG, the management at the time, was the Roxy management, and King Crimson and all that, and he said, right, we're going to do this thing, it's going to last 6 weeks, we're going to do some gigs in Europe, and we can make some money or something. And then one by one, all these gigs got cancelled. And so we ended up with the initial gig in Cromer, the Reading Festival, and the Queen Elizabeth Hall. And so we recorded the Queen Elizabeth Hall. And bizarrely, the Reading Festival, John Peel wrote, this was the best thing of the whole weekend. Because I guess they expected it would just be a bunch of jamming.
Yeah.
But we had rehearsed for 6 weeks.
But out of this album comes the most money you're ever going to earn, right? From one thing.
No.
Have I got it? Where does that come from?
Well, that comes from...
But I just wanted to have one last point on this 801 thing, which is that, because the whole point is that, because we discussed this on the other podcast, that how what an important record that was, certainly to me, Bill McCormack's intro on 801 on Tomorrow Never Knows, was one of the things that made me decide bass was worth sticking with. But... and the idea was those songs would never be played again, right? This band was gone. So am I right in saying that the next time that you ever played East of Asteroid was with me in Sweden?
Oh, my goodness.
With Isildur's Bane.
Did we actually play that?
We actually played it, yes.
God, you must be a good bass player, because it's incredibly difficult to play.
It's quite difficult.
Even I have to count.
And it wasn't 17, even recorded. Let's go. Yes, the sample... in question.
Oh, the sample.
Oh, I've got one other thing I need to say. I need to get this out, because how 801 name came about. Do you know So Eno had a dream, right? Yeah. And in the dream, people were shouting, "We are the 801.
We are the central shaft."
Did you know about this?
Well, obviously I co-produced Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy, and that is the song on there. That's the chorus. Yeah. We are the 801.
But it was a dream, wasn't it?
I can't remember.
But that's the story you told me. We are the 801, we are the central shaft.
Well, that is the lyric from there.
But what does it spell acrostically? I mean, acronym of 801. 801. If you write that down, Spelzina.
My goodness, does it? Well, that's cosmic.
Is it? 8 is E, 0 is N, 1 is O.
If you really want it to be.
Well, yeah.
Do you know, Guy, that...
His father told me this. And it's very important.
I think you had your Lamb Shakespeare revolution. Upside down.
Do you know there's an asteroid, Manzanera asteroid, and its number, by ridiculous coincidence, is 72801. Just...
Okay, and you know
astronomer.
That how?
I know that because... There's a guy got in touch with Eno, and he said, right, I'm an astronomer. What I do for a job is basically discover asteroids and small planets, minor planets. And I've discovered in my lonely nights, I've been listening to 801 Live and stuff like that. I love it to death. I want to name these four asteroids. So Eno, that's one. The other one, John Wetton.
Wow.
Wetton. The other one, Fripp. And then he said... So Eno said, do you want one named after you? I said, yes, please. And so I got in touch with the guy in Boulder, Colorado. He said, absolutely love it. Sent me a lovely email. I mean. And he said, you're never going to believe this, but the number on it is 72801.
By coincidence.
So this 801 thing, I see the number everywhere. It's incredibly lucky.
The bad news is, apparently, it's going to collide with the Earth and destroy.
We haven't got long, so we just need to finish up. But I do want to finish up on this story about really how these few seconds of your life ended up making you the most amount of money.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a guitar riff. It's the title instrumental track of a solo album recorded at Chris Squire's studio, actually. In 1977-8 or something, and it has a riff at the beginning of it. It's played very fast though, and it's something that I needed to do an instrumental, and Simon Phillips was playing drums, Francis Monkman on keyboards, I can't remember if it's Bill Mack on bass or John Wetton, and I was watching the telly and I was like, bing bong bong bong, right, that'll do, tomorrow I'll make something out in the studio. Went in the studio, recorded it. Never listened to it again, probably, and nobody listened to it because it was on K-Scope. Nobody listened to people's solo, my solo albums. And then 40 years later, it slowed down. It appears on Watch the Throne, the title track, No Church in the Wild.
Kanye West.
And Jay-Z.
Kanye West and Jay-Z. It's their first album together. It's the title track. I'm driving along Ladbroke Grove with Charlie, my son, and the phone goes, it's put on speakerphone, it's Rockefeller Records here in New York, just to let you know that Jay-Z and Kanye West have use your riff throughout the whole of their song, and it's coming out next week. So we can't send it to you because it's top secret. We'll play it down the phone. So I said to Charlie, record it on your phone, and then we'll take it to the studio and we'll muck about with it, send it back, say, you can't keep these things here. And I said, oh, well, thanks very much. I put the phone down. And I thought, hang on, are they allowed to do that? So I rang Universal at the time. I said, look, I just had this phone call. Do you know anything about it? I said, oh, yeah. The legal department at Universal. We've been discussing it for ages. You'll be happy. You'll be happy. You're getting more than they are. I said, really? Well, that sounds like I will be happy. And then I thought, hang on. I wrote it as well. Ring the publishers. Do you know anything about this? Yes. We've been negotiating for months. You'll be very happy. I said, oh, well, yeah, but what about if it had some terrible lyric on it? I said, no, don't worry. You'll be happy. So it came out. It won a Grammy. It was in Great Gatsby. It was in every film, Denzel Washington film. It just was, and you go to slot machine and you see the sort of numbers going, the cherries going around. This was like spinning. Every week something would come up. And of course, if it's used in a trailer for a film, you get like 5 times the amount. So I thought, well, hang on, this is where the money is in the music business now. It's in film syncs and trailers and things.
So how did they find it?
Well, they found it because... This schoolmate of Kanye West is a guy called 88 Keys, obviously not his real name, but he's an absolute sweetheart. 88 keys on a piano, obviously. And he specialized in sampling stuff from vinyl that was recorded on analog between 1976 and 1979 only.
I've heard you say this before, and if I just interject, I love this. So he's got a guy who literally his job is just to listen to records from 1976 to 1979, right?
It's his hobby.
That's his. Okay. Because what I'm saying, because he does he have another guy who listens to records from 1971 to 1975, and another guy who listens to records from 1981?
No, he doesn't. This is particular to 88 Keys. Mm. So he gets a call. They're trying to finish their album, Watch the Throne, and they're recording it at the Mercer Hotel in Soho in New York. They hire whole bunch of hotel suites to do their albums, recording in one room's one guy and then another guy. And they ring 88 Keys and they say, look, we want to do one more track. Have you got any beats for us or anything? And he says, no. And I'm late. My wife's going to kill me. I've got the kids to put to bed and all this thing in Brooklyn or something. Go away. And he said, no, you must have something. No, I don't have anything. Just forget it. And he begs and begs, and eventually 88 Key turns up in the hotel room, and there they are, Kanye West and Jay-Z, and they say, okay, play us what you got. He says, oh, really? Okay. And he plays them 10 things, and they get to, what my riff, that one. And that's it. They write a song, they get the guy called The Dream in, they get the blah, 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 and like within a few days it's done, finished, boom, the album's finished. And...
Congratulations. The suit you're wearing is probably due to that.
It is due to that. And of course, I invited, when we did the David Gilmour concert. Radio City Hall. So I invite 88 Keys. So I've got to meet him, and thank him and all this. So he thinks it's my concert. So he, on social media, he puts a Phil Manzanera playing at the thing. And I sort of have to say, no, it's not my concert. It's a David Gilmour concert. I'm just playing along, And he turns up with a copy of K-Scope for me to sign. And he sits. I can't believe this. He never heard of Pink Floyd before. He sits in the audience next to Claire, my wife, and one of the children and stuff. He comes back to say he's asked for me to sign it and everything. I give him a big hug, and say, this is, I love you, mate. Let's set up a Dropbox and I'll send you more stuff. And he's not interested, obviously. No. but it turned out to be a real sweetheart.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Phil, for coming in, and good luck with your book.
Thank you.
And we love the book.
I was going to hold it up, but we absolutely love this book.
We've actually got one we're going to give away on this show. So we're going to have to come up with a question.
Which will be a question based on something that's been in this interview.
Yeah.
Only in this interview.
We'll think of that in the outro. Thank you, mate.
Great.
See you again.
Oh, lovely talking to you guys.
Again. And anyone wants to know anything about the earlier stuff and more detail about Phil joining Roxy, etc., you can go back to episode 3.
Episode 3 of series 1 of Rock on Tours when we had a purple.
Which is all available.
Yeah, I'm sure my voice was higher then. That thing that you put on every week. What is it?
Remember me? I'm in a band. Roxy Music. I think it's because we have to. Everything's better when he says it. I think we probably have to speed it up so we can fit you in.
I see.
Thanks, Phil. All the best. Always nice to have Phil in the
Always
house.
Nice to have Phil in the house, even though this isn't our house.
So the book is worth having, and if you want to own it, there are two ways of owning it. You can either buy it. We didn't actually ask Phil, but I think it's more.
I don't think you can buy it.
You can buy it online, can't you?
I assume you can go
to Amazon or I guess
Amazon or whatever. Or certainly, if you go to Phil, I know Phil's always been very comprehensive with his own website and stuff, and you can probably get it from there.
Yeah.
There's another way,
and it comes with a nice little kind of inside the box is some bug eyes sleeping.
I've got mine. This is my own copy I brought. See, what you don't get is. This inscription
signed to you,
but yes, you get the CD with the which the song he talked about, and this wonderful, let's see what I feel like,
Bug Eyes.
It's like QVC, isn't it?
We are gonna also give one away. We have a copy here that Phil has given us to give away, and the way to get it is to answer this question and put it on our Instagram post that we will put up on Sunday. And
no, don't put it on our Instagram post because then everyone will see it. You have to reply.
No. Thank you. What do you do, Ben?
Put it on the Instagram post.
Yes.
And I'll choose one of those at random.
put it on the Instagram post and you will be chosen at random. Our producer will choose you at random. And the question is,
who is the person whose job it is to find samples for Kanye West who found Phil's sample?
Just name that person and you may be chosen and you will get a book then. Thank you. Anyway, we'll see you next week. Well, I think we have another face-to-face next week.
We do have another face-to-face next week. So I will literally see you.
Yeah, very nice. All right. Until then, it's good night from me.
And good night from them.
Rock On Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.